Hey folks, in today's video, we're going to be picking up where we left off in the previous video, which offered an overview and analysis of the core ideas of Jungian psychology, which is also known as depth psychology. So in that video, I outlined and overviewed the core principles of Carl Jung's approach to analyzing and modeling the human psyche. And that video was based on, or that episode was based on, the first chapter of this recent publication I just put out. It's a 52-page zine called Psychology, Science of the Soul. And in this video, we're going to be circling back around and re-examining some of those core ideas of depth psychology, but we're going to be hearing about it from the mouth of Carl Jung himself. So I've extracted a bunch of clips from various interviews that Carl Jung did in the 1950s, in which he talks about some of the core ideas of his work. And I'm going to be providing some commentary as we go. I also have some clips from Joseph Campbell that are integrated in there. Campbell was a Jungian analyst he wasn't an analyst, but he was somebody who researched mythology, but he comes from a Jungian background. I think he studied with Jung for a few years. So that's what's coming up. I'm really excited about this episode. It's actually going to be a two-parter. So I'm going to go over the core ideas of Jung's approach to the unconscious and the self and the ego. So in the follow-up video, I'm going to be using these ideas and putting them into practice to do a sort of psychoanalysis of modern man. And that, again, in that video, I'm sampling some clips from Jung and from Joseph Campbell and actually from Manly Hall. And I'm also doing commentary too. So it's going to be a two-parter. So let me kick things off by playing a couple clips that are sort of overviewing who Carl Jung was, what makes him special, and so these sort of serve as an introduction to what's to follow.
The American psychoanalyst Dr. Joseph Henderson first met Jung in the 1930s.
It was more wonderful than I had expected, even a wonderful man to work with. It's almost impossible to describe what that was like. A kind of union of a Swiss peasant and a scholar and something more of a more spiritual nature describes a man that technically should not exist but did.
As an analyst, Jung's method was to treat dreams as facts which the doctor or scientist could observe. Jung's approach to the reality of the psyche was innovative and unique.
When you observe the world, you see people, you see houses, you see the sky. You see tangible objects, but when you observe yourself within, you see moving images.
Yes.
A world of images.
Yes.
Generally known as fantasies. Yet these fantasies are facts. It is a fact that a man has such and such a fantasy. And it is such a tangible fact, for instance, that when a man has a certain fantasy, another man may lose his life.
Yes.
Or a bridge is built.
Yes.
These houses were all fantasies.
Yes.
Everything you do here, all of the houses, everything was fantasy to begin with. And fantasy has a proper reality. That is not to be forgotten. Fantasy is not nothing. It is, of course, not a tangible object, but it is a fact, nevertheless. It is a form of energy.
Yes.
Despite the fact we can't measure it.
Yes.
It is a manifestation of something.
Yes.
And that is a reality. The psychical events are facts, are realities. And when you observe the stream of images within, you observe an aspect of the world.
Yes.
Of the world within. Because the psyche, you know, if you understand it as a phenomenon that takes place in so-called living bodies, then it is a quality of matter. As our body consists of matter, we discover that this matter has another aspect, namely a psychic aspect.
Yes. Yes.
And so it is simply the world from within, seen from within.
Yes.
It is just as if we were seeing into another aspect of matter.
Yes.
That means psyche is a quality that appears in matter. doesn't matter whether we understand it or not.
Yes.
But this is the conclusion we come to. If we draw conclusions without prejudices.
The reality of the psyche underpinned all Jung's work, and such was its impact that it brought new words into our everyday language. It was Jung who first used the terms extrovert and introvert, and the word persona for the mask which hides our true self. He coined the word synchronicity for his theory of meaningful coincidence. With Freud, he alerted us to our complexes and made us aware of an unconscious dimension beneath concrete experience.
All right, so from that clip, we get an understanding of one of the things that made Carl Jung so pioneering and path-breaking was that he treated psychological events as facts of nature, meaning that he looked at the psyche as something that was inherently a part of the material reality of the world. But he qualified that by saying that it was a different, it exists at a different level of matter and expresses a different form of energy than the material and energetic forms that we experience in the objective world of matter. So because he took that approach to the psyche and looked at it as real, it allowed him to take a approach to psychological experiences that was very unique in terms of he sought meaning in the symbolism of the psyche, of psychic events. So when he worked with patients, the things that they dreamed about or the experiences that they had, he looked at as inherently meaningful, and he analyzed them as real events, and that they had some sort of purpose, that they were telling you something about the state of that person's psychological being. And so that approach allowed him to make psychological study and psychological analysis empirical, because there's no factor of just saying, oh, that's just, you know, a crazy person. We don't need to take into account what that person is saying that they're experiencing. They're just crazy. He was saying, no, there's something meaningful in every psychological event, because the psyche is a real aspect of nature. And then, as that clip was saying at the end, because he took that approach, he was able to formulate so many breakthrough theories and concepts that are still with us today that we can never really escape from. Things like psychological complexes and personality types. So that's sort of a basic introduction. Now in this next clip, I'm going to pick back up off where the first person in that previous clip was talking about how kind of unique and special Carl Jung was. We're going to be looking at how Jung was not just a psychoanalyst, but he was really a polymath who was interested in a lot of different fields. For example, he incorporated concepts from quantum theory and sort of certain branches of physics that were breakthrough ideas that were occurring in physics during his era. He incorporated them into his concepts of the psyche as an energetic system. But importantly, for listeners of this channel, he also incorporated esoteric philosophy and the study of alchemy and astrology and Taoism. And sort of like Eastern philosophies and religions. He studied and incorporated all those into his own model of the human psyche. So we're going to be hearing a little bit about some people who had firsthand experiences with him in discussing his other interests.
Jung's work covered more than just clinical observation. He considered the psychological meaning of mythology and fairy tales, of alchemy, astrology, and flying saucers. He received honorary doctorates all around the world on his 80th birthday in 1955. Despite his vast range of work and thought, and the international reputation he had gained, Jung retained his humor and humility.
I made some comment about his encyclopedic knowledge. The reason it was so meaningful to me was that it didn't come out like knowledge. That it wasn't, he wasn't casting pearls before swine, and he wasn't preaching a gospel, and he wasn't doing any of those things. And he said, the older I get, and he was a child of then of about 75, I guess. And he said, the older I get, the more I realize that I don't know enough to entirely cover my little fingernail. There'd be room for a bit more.
He wrote the first introduction to Zen Buddhism. He began with Greek mythology, or didn't begin, but at least brought it in. He, you know, the gods and the goddesses, the myths. He was concerned with the American Indians. He visited them. He was interested in synchronicity. He was interested in astrology. And he wrote on all these subjects and had lots of good things to say about them.
So those watching the video will notice I just paused and did a quick beard trim because it was kind of driving me crazy as I was editing these videos. But yeah, let me get back to the commentary. In that previous segment, they mentioned that Jung commented on UFOs, and that's a topic that we're going to be revisiting in part B of this video on the topic of the need for a new mythology for the scientific age. Now, in the next clip, we're going to be hearing about a little bit of autobiographical detail about how Carl Jung came to formulate his unique approach to analyzing the human psyche. And this is going to be discussing how Jung originally came up working with Freud and then famously had a split with Freud. And the nature of his split had to do with him formulating his concept of the collective unconscious.
Can we move on to the time when you did eventually part company with Freud? It was partly, I think, with the publication of your book, The Psychology of the Unconscious. Is that correct?
That was the real cause.
Well, now, before you...
The final cause, because it had a long preparation.
Freud had dealt mainly with neurotics, people he could talk to, and he saw his task as that of strengthening the rational ego so it could cope with life. But Jung, as a psychiatrist in a mental hospital, had dealt with the altogether more fearsome world of true madness, psychosis, where the ego is overwhelmed by the violence of the unconscious.
Jung saw the unconscious as creative and independent. Freud thought it just contained what the conscious mind repressed. The more Jung investigated the unconscious, the less he could agree with Freudian theory.
Was it not partly your observation, your clinical observation, of psychotic cases which led you to differ from Freud on this?
It was partially my experience with schizophrenic patients that led me to the idea of certain general historical conditions. And this experience and others led me then to the hypothesis that there is an impersonal stratum in our psyche.
I knew of psychopathic cases, just, you know, in the balance between schizophrenia and hysteria, where ideas came up, delusions that were not exactly hysterical, because they were singularly difficult to understand. It was a sort of strange eruptions. It was mythological material of the nature of which wasn't understood. And there I tried for the first time to produce a picture of the functioning of the unconscious. There is a sort of unconscious that clearly produces things which are historical and not personal.
So those just overviewed how he got into studying the unconscious, and now I'm going to play a couple clips where he just talks more about the nature of the unconscious.
I took the existence of the unconscious for a real fact. Or for a real autonomous factor capable of independent action.
Yes.
A matrix, a sort of basis of consciousness of a creative nature, namely capable of autonomous acts. autonomous intrusions into consciousness. In our psyche, there are two consciousness, is one factor, and there is another factor, equally important, that is the unconscious, that can interfere with consciousness any time it pleases. The whole of philosophy of our days has not yet recognized this fact, that we have a counteractor in our unconscious. And of course, I say to myself now, this is very uncomfortable, because I think I am the only master in my house, but I must admit that there is another somebody in that house that can play tricks. And I had to deal with the unfortunate victims of that interference every day in my patients.
I want to emphasize something that he said there, and this is a point I made in the previous video, is that his idea, which is his probably most breakthrough, most important idea, that the human psyche, through its dimension of the unconscious, exists as a very real factor in human existence, but is one that we're not conscious of. But yet it is a very real factor, and that this unconscious level extends from the personal level to a transpersonal level. And that it's the dynamics within this transpersonal dimension of the unconscious can come in and interfere with the individual dynamics of consciousness or the individual person's psyche. This factor or this principle of the collective coming in and influencing the individual is a fundamental aspect of his psychology, but it's not one that is incorporated in any type of historical or geopolitical analysis that you see in the sort of public debate or in academia or in any in think tanks. You just never see this type of analysis. The premise or the set of assumptions that underlie analytical thinking in every sphere of social science and sort of history and politics that we see today is all premised upon the idea of individuals, that human beings are just a mass of individuals. And the principal theme of Jungian psychology is that that is not true. That's only one layer. At another layer, there is a collective mankind level of psychology. There's a universal mind that exists as a very real factor in human life, but that this universal mind in relation to the individual's waking consciousness is unconscious, meaning it's like yin yang. Our waking consciousness is yang, but the universal mind, the collective unconscious, is yin. It's not actively expressing itself to our waking state of mind, but yet it's present and a very real factor in human life. And so when we incorporate this consideration of the collective unconscious, which is what I'm going to do in the second part of this two video series, we're going to understand that, or we're going to see how transformative this idea of the collective unconscious is, because this idea of there's a collective stratum to human psychology, that's where the idea, the sort of Platonic ideas of archetypes come in, and we understand how these mass motions within the universal mind, or how the archetypal motions within the universal mind can come in and set the stage to manifest mass motions in human psychology and human behavior on the Earth scale. And then that also sets the stage for us to be able to incorporate astrology into modern science and modern psychology, because we can understand that the archetypes in the collective unconscious actually correlate with the motions of the planets in the zodiac. And then that becomes a very powerful thing, because then we can look at history and we can start to correlate motions of planets with and sort of cycles of planetary transits with sort of the cycles of human history and human behavior and activity, and we can see patterns between the two. And in the third chapter of this zine, this publication, I do just that, and I do a case study of, in particular, Pluto and Saturn, and show how their cycles throughout history constellate with these mass motions and mass behavioral events and mass psychological events within mankind. And when you look at the different wars that have taken place in the 20th century, you can see a clear relationship between the archetypes of Pluto and Saturn and the manifestation of those archetypes. And so these on the level of human society and human civilization. And so this is how breakthrough and important and just fundamentally important this Jungian psychology is, and taking this approach that Jung took and realizing that there's a collective stratum of human life that is fundamentally integrative in terms of bringing individuals together into one common field of psychological activity. And so I just want to emphasize that because it's so important. And particularly when you're looking at the events of today and you're trying to understand how so much psychotic behavior can be taking place, we have to begin to incorporate and factor in this idea that there's a collective level of human psychology that's being enacted. And that factor, that analysis completely transforms what the lessons to be learned are and what the sort of solutions ultimately must be that come out of this situation, and how it's not adequate to just look at this idea that it's they that are doing is this is hidden entity, these bad people, these, you know, greedy elite. Like, yes, that exists, but wherever human beings exist, you know, we're only different and separate on one level. Even on the level of class, classes are only separate from, or even the old idea of the caste system, that individuals are only segmented into the poor and the rich and the powerful and the sort of subjugated. That only exists on one level of human existence. On another level, all of us transcend these polarities to be united within one field of consciousness, or one field of the psyche, the collective psyche. And I just want to emphasize that. Now, I'm going to continue on in a bit with this analysis of the unconscious, and we're going to go into the archetypes, but I want to play a sort of extended clip that goes into Jung's theory of psychological types and how he formulated that in his psychoanalytic work with patients. And so how he was able to, by meeting with all kinds of patients from all different walks of life, he was able to start mapping out this idea that humans sort of constellate into different psychological, different archetypes or archetypal patterns of psychological expressions. And these archetypal patterns he terms the psychological types. And this is something that I overviewed in the previous video, because I cover it in my zine, but it has to do with introversion, extroversion, thinking, intuition, feeling, and sensation. And so the chemistry of how those factors fit together, which is what you're measuring in a Myers-Briggs test, those tell you something about how about where each person falls in terms of how they're expressing these archetypal principles. So there's a clustering, you know, even though there's 7 billion people in the world, there will be a clustering of psychological types of how the individual expresses their own psychology. And that fits into a relatively well-organized pattern. And so Jung was the first one to articulate this idea that there are these essential patterns that each person draws from in formulating their own psychology. And so these patterns are the psychological types. And so we're going to see this clip is about 10 minutes long, but it's very informative and instructive in terms of describing his theory of the psychological types and how he came to formulate them.
In 1921, Jung published Psychological Types.
I've never known anything that was as illuminating as that book was. Suddenly we'd got tools to work with. Instead of trying to exterminate each other, we could understand much better why we were the way we were and why we came on as we did come on and so forth and so forth. And it was enormously helpful.
Oh, it was a revelation. It was absolutely revolutionary in our lives.
Joe and Jane Wheelwright were both patients of Jung, and both became analysts. More than 50 years ago, Jung's English assistant gave Joe Wheelwright a copy of Psychological Types, the work which gave us the terms introvert and extrovert and the four psychological functions. Jung defined four main types from his observations of patients, friends and colleagues: thinking, feeling, sensation and intuition. The Wheelwrights themselves are a vivid illustration of Jung's theory of types and of his view that opposite types attract and then get into conflict.
Everybody knows that women feel and men think. I mean, that's on page 3 of any book that you pick up. Well, in our family, it happens to be t'other way which. I can't think my way out of a paper bag, and my wife has an absolutely first-class mind.
Women are supposed to feel, and men are supposed to think. Joe did the feeling, and I did the thinking, and so we were upside down.
Tell me what Jung's theory of typology has meant to you in a personal way.
Well, I'm an introvert, and I'm a sensation type.
What does that mean exactly?
Sensation means facts. It's got to be a fact. You can't fool around with it. You've got to nail it down. It's got to be black and white. And then secondarily, thinking. And for a woman, that wasn't allowed in those days.
Her dominant functions were sensation and thinking. That's yours were what?
Mine, intuition and feeling. We're polar opposites.
In that order?
We're polar opposites. Yes, and she's very introverted, and I'm slightly extroverted.
Only slightly?
Only slightly, of course, fanatically.
Francis, it is very often the case, one could almost say, it is almost a rule, but I don't want to make too many rules with it, in order not to be schematic, that an introvert marries an extrovert for compensation. Or another type, marries the counter type, to complement himself.
Did that also mean that you were in conflict?
Lots of conflict. I didn't know what was going on half the time with him. And he was baffled by me.
We were saying very nasty things to each other and doing an awful lot of misunderstanding. And my relationship to Jane was then, as it has been always, the central fact of my life, I think. So I wanted to do something about it. Our marriage would have probably had to break up if we'd gone on in blissful ignorance. So that's what really brought me into Jungian psychology, was the type stuff.
Well, Dr. Jung, of course, tied in with your typology and quotation marks of introversion, extroversion. We, of course, know of your concepts of thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. And, of course, it would be very interesting to hear some expansion of the meaning of these particular terms as related to the introvert-extrovert dichotomy.
Well, there is quite a simple explanation of these terms, and it shows at the same time how I arrived at such a typology. Namely, sensation tells you that there is something. Thinking, roughly speaking, tells you what it is. Feeling tells you whether it is agreeable or not, to be accepted or not, accepted or rejected.
Yes.
And intuition out there is a difficulty.
Yes.
You don't know ordinarily how intuition works. So when a man has a hunch, you can't tell exactly how he got that hunch or where that hunch comes from. So my definition is, intuition is a perception by ways or means of the unconscious. It is a perception by intermediate links. You need your intuition because you cannot possibly tell by your perceptions, by your sense perceptions, what there is going to happen. For instance, you are traveling in primeval forest. You only see for a few steps ahead. Mm-hmm. You go by the compass, perhaps, and you don't know what there is ahead. It is uncharted country. If you use your intuition, then you have hunches. And when you live under such primitive conditions, you instantly are aware of hunches. For instance, there are places that are favorable, there are places that are not favorable. You can't tell for your life what it is.
Yes.
But you better follow these hunches.
Yes.
Have you concluded what psychological type you are yourself?
Naturally, I have devoted a great deal of attention to that painful question, you know.
And reached a conclusion?
Well, you see, the type is nothing static. It changes in the course of life. But I most certainly was characterized by thinking. I always thought, from early childhood on. And I had a great deal of intuition too. And I had a definite difficulty with feeling. And my relation to reality was not particularly brilliant. I was often at variance with the reality of things. Now that gives you all the necessary data for a diagnosis.
Would you say that a person who has clairvoyance, in a sense, would then be an intuitive type? Person in his experiment is more likely to...
That's quite probable. Or it can be a sensation type. Say an extrovert sensation type that is very much influenced by the unconscious.
I see.
Because he has introverted intuition in his unconscious.
I see.
You see, there are two groups, you see, the rational group and the irrational group. The rational group is thinking and feeling, because the ideal thinking is a rational result.
That's right.
Feeling also a rational result, rational values.
Yes.
That is differentiated feeling. Whereas sensation must needs be irrational because it may not prejudice facts.
Yes.
You see?
Yes.
It shall not prejudice facts. The real ideal perception is that you have an accurate perception of the things as they are, without addition or corrections.
Yeah.
On the other side, the intuition does not look at the things as they are. That is prison, that is anathema to the intuition.
Yeah.
It looks, ever so shortly at the things as they are, and makes off into an unconscious process, at the end of which he has seen something nobody else would have seen.
Yes.
So you see, we have constantly warnings, hints that consist perhaps in a slight feeling of uneasiness, uncertainty, fear. Now, under primitive circumstances, you pay attention to these things. They mean something. With us in our man-made, absolutely, apparently safe conditions, we don't need that function so very much.
Yes.
Yet we still use it. So you find them intuitive types, for instance, amongst bankers, Wall Street men.
Yeah.
They follow hunches, you know, gamblers of all descriptions.
Yeah.
You find the type very frequently among doctors,
yeah,
because it helps them in their prognosis. That is perception by the way of the unconscious.
Yeah.
And you can observe that with intuitive types. You see, intuitive types very often do not perceive by their eyes or by their ears. They perceive by intuition. For instance, once it happened that I had a woman patient in the morning at 9 o'clock, and she came and said, "But you begin earlier." I said, "You call it early at 9 o'clock?" "But no, you must have seen somebody at 8 o'clock." I said, "How do you know?" Then she said, "Oh well, I just a hunch. There must have been a gentleman with you this morning." I said, But how do you know it was a gentleman? You said, oh, well, I just had the impression, the atmosphere was just like,
yeah,
like a gentleman here.
Yeah.
All the time, you know, the ashtray was under her nose, and there was a yeah, half-smoked cigar. But she wouldn't notice it.
Yeah.
So you see, the intuitive is a type that doesn't see the stumbling block before his feet. But he's had for 10 miles.
Yes.
Okay, now I want to pick back up with this discussion and analysis of the unconscious, and in particular the collective unconscious.
Now, the distinction then between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious then is that the personal is could be more involved with the immediate life of the individual.
Oh, yes.
And the collective would be universal, would be the same elements of all men.
It would be collective.
The unconscious clearly produces things which are historical and not personal.
Yes.
It is a factor in its own dignity and a very important factor, because it can create the most horrible disturbances.
So by horrible disturbances, he's really referring to this concept of the collective shadow, which has to do with these repressed aspects of the psyche that gets constellated on a collective scale. So you have this like collective repression, which gets activated by archetypal factors and manifests as these mass sort of like psychosis events of the type that we see being discussed and analyzed today under the concept of mass formation psychosis. So Carl Jung comes to that concept through his idea of the collective shadow. And I'll be going more into that in chapter 3 of this zine, which I haven't yet done the video for, but look out for that. So in this next section, we're going to be looking at Jung's concept of the self. And self for Jung is a very dynamic concept. On one hand, it's the master archetype that exists within the collective unconscious. So in this perspective, it's the center of the psyche around which the other archetypes sort of rotate and orbit. And so it's the fundamental driving factor, the primary source of causation of all psychic events for each person. On another hand, the self is also the container or the wholeness of the psyche. So the self, the domain of the self, is both the conscious mind and the unconscious. And it factors in and incorporates the ego. So the ego is its downward polarity. There's the self-ego. There's the self within the unconscious, and there's the ego as the center of the conscious mind. But the ego is not independent of the self. The self incorporates the whole of the psyche. So that's what Jung's going to be talking about here.
The self is merely a term that designates the whole personality.
Whole personality.
Because the whole personality of man is indescribable.
Yes.
His consciousness can be described. His unconscious cannot be described, because the unconscious, as I must repeat myself, is always unconscious.
Yes.
And it is really unconscious, but really does not know it.
Does not know about it.
When I say self, then you must not think of I myself, because that is only your empirical self, and that is covered by the term ego.
Ego, yes.
But when it is matter of the self, then it is matter of a personality that is more complete than the ego, because the ego is only consists of what you are conscious of.
Yes.
You see, while I am talking, I am conscious of what I say, I am conscious of myself, yet only to a certain extent. Quite a lot of things happen. For instance, I make gestures. I'm not conscious of them.
Yes.
They happen unconsciously. You can see them.
Yes.
I may say or use words, and I can't remember at all having used those words, or even at the moment I'm not conscious of them.
Yes.
So any amount of unconscious things occur in my conscious condition. I'm never wholly conscious of myself.
Yes.
And so we don't know our unconscious personality. We have hints. We have certain ideas, but we don't know it really. Nobody can say where man ends. That is the beauty of it, you know. Yeah. It's very interesting. Yeah. The unconscious of man can reach God knows where. There we are going to make discoveries.
Now we're going to explore some of the mysteries of the collective unconscious, and we're going to start to explore the idea of archetypes.
Jung's approach to the problem of the elementary ideas, he calls archetypes of the unconscious. These are, in some way, features in the unconscious, and experiences that come in through the nervous system are assimilated and interpreted in terms of these psychological archetypes.
The archetypes, they are instinctual images that are not intellectually invented. They are always there, and they produce certain processes in the unconscious. One could best compare with myths. That's the origin of mythology. Mythology is a pronouncing of series of images that formulate the life of archetypes.
Here we come to a very important point, the association with archetypes and mythology. And this is really where Joseph Campbell comes in, and he specializes in the study of mythology and the extraction of the archetypal themes that exists behind the different mythological systems of world history. So I want to play a couple case studies here that discuss the relationship between the archetypes, the existence of the collective unconscious, and different mythological themes that you see behind different cultures of the world. And so to begin with, I have a case study here with the snake, the symbolism of the snake, and the archetypal elements involved.
In his travels and studies, Jung saw mythologies as the expression of the collective unconscious. When stories, images, or symbols appeared in similar form but in different cultures, he called them archetypes. These represent a common human inheritance of patterns of thought and action, or basic psychological instincts. Some symbols recur in almost every sand painting. Lightning flashes, rainbows, and the warrior gods and star gods are the most common. They are found in many different cultures, and Jung recognized these symbolic strands as archetypes. One symbol that appears constantly across cultures, in religion, mythology, and dreams, is the serpent or snake.
In Navajo painting, the snake appears in a great many of the chants. The great majority of them have the snake in it somewhere, and this is also true of people's dreams. In a lengthy analysis, there's almost always very important dreams that center around the snake.
Well, the snake is one of the best symbols of the unconscious itself. It inspires fear, but at the same time, it inspires curiosity and a kind of beauty that relates it to the possibility of a sort of earth wisdom.
So Jung thought it represented the kind of lower nervous system, the spine and the lower parts of the brain stem. So that was the snake, that deep unconscious power that governs us even when we don't know it.
I spoke of the serpent yesterday, cast its skin to be born again. So the serpent represents the power of life, energy, and consciousness to throw off death. But it is in the field of death. It's consciousness in the field of death, throwing off death and putting on new bodies. Reincarnation. And life has moved on. It's throwing off these bodies and putting on new. This is symbolic then of life energy and consciousness engaged in the field of time, the field of death and birth.
I also want to point out that in the philosophy of yoga, the serpent is symbolic of the kundalini energy that is coiled up and sort of trapped in the root chakra. And part of the point of the practice of yoga is to gradually awaken and raise that coiled serpent. I'm going to play another case study next. This one has to do with the symbolism of the circle and its relationship to the self. And in this one, we're going to hear from Joseph Campbell.
Your friend Jung, the great psychologist, says that the most powerful religious symbol is the circle. He says the circle is one of the great primordial images of mankind, that in considering the symbol of the circle, we are analyzing the self. And I find you in your own work throughout the course of your life coming across the circle, whether it's in the magical designs the world over, whether it's in the architecture, both ancient and modern, whether it's in the dome-shaped temples of India or the calendar stones of the Aztecs or the ancient Chinese bronze shields or the visions of the Old Testament prophet Ezekiel, whom you talk about, the wheel in the sky. You keep coming across this image.
Yeah, it's an ever-present thing. It's the center from which you've come, back to which you go.
And Jung kept returning to that theme of the circle as being the sort of universal symbol. Why do you suppose the circle became so universally symbolic?
Well, because it's experienced all the time. You experience it in the day and the year, just as we've said, and you experience it in leaving home, going on your adventure, hunting, or whatever it may be, and coming back to home. In the great tantric monasteries outside of Lhasa, for instance, Gyutdo, they practiced sand painting, cosmic images, and so forth, indicating the forces of the spiritual powers that operate in our lives. It's astonishing when one studies these things in depth, the degree to which the agreements go between totally separated cultures.
Which says something about the commonality of the species, doesn't it?
Well, yes. That was Carl Jung's idea, which he calls the archetypes of the collective unconscious. And they are expressions of the structure of the human psyche. This speaks for certain powers in the psyche, which are common to all mankind.
In a moment, we're going to return to this idea of the self and its association with the archetype of God. And we're also going to be exploring the relationship that this archetype plays in religion, in man's religion. And sort of implied by that is the role that mythology plays in religion. And so that's coming up. But first, I want to do a bit of an exploration of another core concept from Jungian psychology, which is known as the anima and the animus. And the anima and the animus are archetypes within the unconscious, but they express themselves depending on someone's gender and sexuality. And so whatever is dominantly polarized in the individual, whether that be a sort of a masculine sexuality or a feminine sexuality, then the corollary to that will be expressed and reside within the unconscious as an anima or animus complex. And that unconscious factor impresses itself upon the individual psyche in various forms that have to do with how you're attracted to people of whatever sexuality you're attracted to. So normally, and traditionally, this is talked about in terms of male, female. In the male, the sort of like psyche is polarized towards a masculine expression, and then therefore there is a feminine counterpart within the unconscious, which is known as the anima, and vice versa with a female and the animus. But sort of in modern society, there's a lot of people whose sexuality and sexual preferences and attraction doesn't fit into that neat paradigm. So you could have, I think, a female who's attracted to other women. So even though they're female biologically, they could have a sort of animus dominant expression in their psyche, which would mean that they would have an anima complex within their unconscious that would drive them towards this attraction to women. But anyway, we're going to be exploring this archetype of the anima and the animus and the role that it plays in human psychology in this next clip.
Knowledge of the unconscious is gained by the ego by way of projections. The unconscious, and this is something that is really serious, the unconscious is unconscious. You don't know what's down there until you experience it by way of a projection. So, a woman walks in the room and I'm struck. What's happened? She has received my anima projection, and then I marry the creature. Now, I don't know what I'm doing, really. What I'm really joining up with is a projection of my own psyche.
Jung observed that for every woman, there was a masculine aspect within her psyche, the archetype of the animus, and for every man, a feminine counterpart, the anima.
The anima is an archetypal form expressing the fact that a man has a minority of feminine or female genes.
Yeah.
And that is something that doesn't disappear in him, that is constantly present, and it works as a female in a man. The same is the case with the animus, that is a masculine image in a woman's mind.
And the whole point is that the female ego has to be in charge of the animus.
That men use the image of female perfection to motivate themselves. That's precisely what they do. You see that in the Tom Sawyer story. So Tom Sawyer is about 12 years old, and he's still hanging around with his friends, like Huck Finn. And this girl moves across the street, Becky, and she comes out, and he's struck by her for the first time in his life. Something's changed. And the first thing he does is hop up on a picket fence and show off and balance in front of her. And he's saying, well, look at me, look at me. He's like the male bowerbird building something beautiful so the female will approve of it. And it's motivation. You know, and that's something that I think modern women don't really understand about men. They don't understand that, at least to the degree that males are uncorrupted and not bitter because of being rejected, they're doing everything they can to kneel before the eternal image of the feminine and try to make themselves worthy. That's the chivalry story. I don't know if women have any idea how paralyzing they are to especially young men. A very large number of my clinical clients, but also young men I've talked to in general, are absolutely terrified of women because they're terrified of being rejected. And the terror exists in precise proportion to their attraction to the woman, which is a horrible paradoxical situation to be in. It's often why men make such fools of themselves in front of women that they're attracted to. It's because, first of all, they don't see the woman that they're attracted to, because what the hell do they know about her? They don't see her as an individual. They see her as the manifestation of a judgmental ideal. And then it's only in establishing the relationship with the actual woman that they can start differentiating between the judgmental ideal and the actual individual woman. And that also requires a sacrifice. And the sacrifice is, you never can have an ideal woman. So to have a relationship with any woman, you have to sacrifice the relationship with the ideal woman. And you have to see the individual woman and separate her from the ideal.
That woman of his choice, as one says, not no choice, he has been captured. You know, he sees that she is no good at all, that she is a hell of a business. And he tells me so, and he says, for God's sake, doctor, help me to get rid of that woman. He can't. He's like clay in her fingers. And that is the archetype. That is so-called archetype of the anima.
Man insists upon making some outer figure, generally a flesh and blood woman, bear his anima for him. That is, he mediates the outer world by way of his anima instead of using her inside where she belongs. this produces more suffering and more upset and more pain than any other single thing that I know about.
Now, see, the archetype is a force, it has an autonomy. It can suddenly seize you. It is like a seizure. So, for instance, falling in love at first sight, that is such a case. You see, you have a certain image in yourself without knowing it of the woman, of the woman.
Yes.
Now you see that girl, or at least a good imitation of your type. And instantly you get a seizure and you're gone.
Yeah.
And afterwards you may discover that it was a hell of a mistake.
And it doesn't take long in marriage for a fact to show through. You thought you were marrying this and you got that. And here comes the typical problem. Now, what are you going to do? There are two possibilities. One, you can say, darling, I am disillusioned. I'm taking my anima back for reprojection. And this can go on. The only alternative is to transform passion into compassion and say, well, dear, all right, I accept the fact. And then there comes what we call love. Love is really the relationship to the person. It's a person-to-person relationship that develops. Otherwise, there's tension, but there has to be a reconciliation with the fact world. And this we call maturation.
The animus to me is one of the most significant concepts that has arisen in Jungian psychology. It speaks of the function that connects a woman with her deepest self and personhood, her creativity, the unformed that's forming as she ages, her work, her word, her ideas, herself.
So now I want to revisit the self and correlate it with, in religion, what we call God. And so psychologically, the engagement with the self is, in religious terms, an encounter or an experience of the divine. And so in this next clip, we're going to hear from Joseph Campbell talk about God as this archetypal motif in world mythology. And he's going to take a psychoanalytical approach to looking at this. And then we're also going to hear a little bit from Jung.
So if you find in a variety of cultures, each one telling the story of creation, or the story of a virgin birth, or the story of a savior who comes and dies and is resurrected, you're saying something about what is inside us and the need to understand.
That's right.
So when one scripture talks about being made in his image, in God's image, it's being created with certain qualities that every human being possesses, no matter what that person's religion or culture or geography or heritage.
God would be the ultimate elementary idea of man.
You see, the idea of a deity is not an intellectual idea. It is an archetype. It's an archetypal idea. Therefore, you find it practically everywhere under this or another name. It is an all-powerful, extraordinary effect or quality that human, you know. Now, that is the living experience of an archetype. And that is the thing that people are looking for.
Yes.
An archetypal experience that gives them an incorruptible value.
From his starting point, all religious ideas are equally valid as expressions of human psychic life. And all religious truths and religious objects are simply psychological.
We all have a religious side, and it was one of Jung's courageous statements saying that we cannot deal with human psyche without having to deal with religion.
for him, religious realities are realities because they have effects. They bring about events in our psychic life and so on. Jung was a non-realist about religion. That is, he didn't think of religious objects as beings out there. He thought their true and most vivid meaning was within the psyche. So, for example, the real encounter with God was the encounter with your own unconscious.
So I have one more clip here to finish off this episode. And remember, this is a two-parter, so this is going to be the end of part one, and then it'll be followed with a part two. But in this final clip, I'm going to play the famous Jung quote where he talks about whether he believes in God and the fact that he doesn't believe, he knows. Just now we played a quote where Jung was talking about how there's this idea of the noumen, a noumenous experience, which is a type of enlightening experience, enlivening and enlightening experience of consciousness in which the divine is encountered and experienced. And so I think what Jung is implying here when he says he knows is that he's had such an experience himself, and that confirms the theory for him. And actually, this is something that we talked about in the previous video, and I read a few quotes from Jung in which he describes some of his experience of the divine, some of these numinous experiences. But anyway, I'm going to play this clip, that this famous Jung clip, and then Don Cuppett, who we've heard commenting on a couple other earlier clips, he's going to do a analysis of Jung's quote there, and then I'm going to conclude right there this episode, and so we'll pick back up with part two. Thanks for tuning in.
And did you believe in God?
Oh, yes.
Do you now believe in God?
Now? Difficult to answer. I know. I don't need to believe. I know.
What did Jung mean by claiming, at the end of his life, to know God? Realizing that religion is truly human, he sets aside supernaturalism, and instead he brings forward the old mystical idea that the knowledge of God is in the end the same thing as self-knowledge. For Jung, the knowledge of God means a condition of inner integration, blessedness, wisdom, harmony with oneself and all nature, that our psyches are pursuing all our lives. Jung's new sort of religious naturalism has a lot to teach all of us. Indeed, I suspect in the end we're all going to have to follow him.